Today is Saturday, June 27th, and this is the World Socialist website. Articles have been read by an automated narration. For these articles and more, visit the World Socialist website at wsws.org. WOS webinar on the American Revolution, the historical significance and contemporary relevance of 1776. On the eve of the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, the World Socialist website convened a significant global webinar, The American Revolution and Its Place in History, From the War Against Monarchy to No Kings. The event was co-moderated by David North, chairman of the WSWS International Editorial Board, and Eric Lee, a federal civil litigator who has played a major role in the fight to defend democratic rights. The webinar brought together leading historians of the American Revolution and Civil War. James Oakes and Sean Willens are among the foremost scholars of slavery, emancipation, and American democracy. Oakes, a two-time Lincoln Prize winner and author of Freedom National, and Willens, the Bancroft Prize-winning author of The Rise of American Democracy. Richard Carwarden, former president of Corpus Christi College, Oxford, is a biographer of Lincoln and himself a two-time Lincoln Prize winner. Adam Hochschild, the renowned author of King Leopold's Ghost in American Midnight, and labor historian Thomas Mackeman of King's College, who conducted the WSWS's 2019 interviews with historians on the 1619 Project, also took part. The WSWS webinar stands as the only serious discussion held with leading historians on the causes, implications, and enduring relevance of the American Revolution during this critical anniversary. This itself speaks to the disinterest and indeed hostility of the entire political establishment and official media to the bourgeois democratic traditions of the United States itself. From workers and youth, however, the webinar has drawn a powerful response. Viewership has passed 2,000 as of this writing, and readers across the world have written in, many expressing enthusiasm at finding a defense of the American Revolution mounted from the left. The webinar could not be more timely. North opened with the warning that the anniversary unfolds amid an escalating assault on democratic rights and the foundations of American democracy. Trump, he noted, has spoken openly of dictatorial rule. After losing the 2020 election, he attempted to overturn its result and block the peaceful transfer of power. His return to office in 2024 marked not only a breakdown of democratic institutions, but also a profound erosion of democratic consciousness. It is precisely this turn toward dictatorship, North explained, that makes the study of the revolutionary traditions of the United States a political necessity. The Declaration of Independence was revolutionary, he said, because it indicted the existing social and political order and called for its overthrow in the most sweeping and universal terms, and its principles transcended the objective limitations imposed upon it by its own time. It was, he said, both of its time and of the future, and for that reason its defense is inseparable from the defense of democratic rights today. The revolution must be studied critically as, in North's words, an opportunity to ask what was revolutionary in the revolution, what was limited, what was betrayed, what was carried forward, and what remains unresolved. The webinar took up that task. It addressed an enormous breadth of political, intellectual, and historical issues that range across 2.5 centuries. The panel examined the society from which the revolution sprang, and it traced the revolution's global reach. Willens declared, "You can't understand any of the other revolutions without understanding the American Revolution," while Hochschild traced the abolitionist networks that carried the famous British diagram of a slave ship to Benjamin Franklin in Philadelphia and to Lafayette in Paris. The international thread ran on into the Civil War. Carwardine recalled the grief in British cities at Lincoln's assassination, and Mackeman noted that Marx, writing for the International Working Men's Association, helped turn the British working class against the Confederacy. The webinar followed the enduring strength of the Declaration's principles down through American history. Oakes observed that the labor radicals of the late 19th and early 20th centuries repeatedly invoked the Declaration of Independence, as had the movements for abolition and women's suffrage before them. And the panelists examined the relentless assault upon those principles as the class struggle sharpened and American imperialism emerged at the turn of the 20th century. Drawing on his book, American Midnight, Hochschild reconstructed the repression during and after the First World War, and Valence drew the line to the present, noting that the one Alien and Sedition Act still on the books is the Alien Enemies Act of 1798, the statute upon which Donald Trump has seized in order to do his mass deportations. But the question to which the discussion repeatedly returned, and the one that gave the webinar its central purpose, was the revolutionary character of the revolution itself. Oakes spoke to the universalism of the Declaration, whose assertion of universal human equality establishes an entirely new revolutionary standard by which every social movement from that point on is evaluated. Carwardine described it as the formal end of a world of ascribed status, in which a person's place was fixed by birth and rank. Violence drew out the two revolutions, one against monarchy and aristocracy, the other against slavery that would culminate in the Civil War, and the radicalism of an upheaval that overturned a social order founded on inherited rank. Mackeman stressed the importance of the Declaration's proclamation of the right of revolution and the principle of equality, the most powerful idea, not only in American, but in world history. This was a direct answer to the campaign to deny that 1776 was a revolution at all. Mackeman confronted the claim, advanced by Gerald Horn's The Counter-Revolution of 1776 and, above all, by the New York Times' 1619 Project, that the rebellion was no revolution or even a counter-revolution to protect slavery. In its time, if noted, nobody, including its enemies, thought it was anything but a revolution. This denigration of 1776, he argued, is a systematic campaign waged from the milieu of the Democratic Party, employing a racialist falsification of history to recast the revolution as a reactionary defense of slavery. Both Mackeman and Willence identified its method as presentism and anachronism, the past judged by the standards of the present and great events reduced to moralistic condemnations of the individuals involved. Against this, the panel counterposed a defense of reason and the Enlightenment. What predominates in academia today, North argued, is a petty bourgeois view of history that substitutes race for class. History cannot be understood through moral denunciation, he insisted, for it has no explanatory power, and the racial outlook rests on a perverted zoological conception with no application to social history. Oakes drew the corollary. The universalist principle of human equality is seriously antithetical to identity politics, which breaks people down into subgroups. Throughout, the panel insisted on the Declaration's living relevance. Hochschild read its indictment of George III, the military rendered superior to the civil power, people transported beyond seas for pretended offenses, domestic insurrection incited, and observed that the charges read as if they were written this morning in answer to the Trump administration. Lee pointed to the Supreme Court's 6-3 decision handed down the same day stripping rights from immigrants and to the fact that the organizers of the January 6 coup walk free while protesters at ICE detention camps face prison sentences of 30, 40, and even 50 years. In his closing remarks, North returned to the critical, theoretical questions involved in an analysis of the American Revolution. History matters, he argued, because it adds complexity to our understanding of the present and lets us place the moment within a far broader trajectory. He quoted Lincoln, "Our occasion is piled high with difficulty," and observed that things look most impossible at the point in which the greatest change is in the offing. From this came a revolutionary optimism in the face of the rampaging reaction of the oligarchy. To be an optimist is to see not only the difficulties, but contained within those difficulties, the possibility of renewal. North ventured a prediction that the America and the world of 2036 will look vastly different from the world of today, pointing to the revolutionary potential within the international working class, a globalized society, and growing social opposition. The greatest challenge of the present, he concluded, is the fight for a historical consciousness. The fight over the meaning of 1776, North concluded, is a fight over the political consciousness and perspective required for the future. The defense of the most basic democratic rights will not be carried through by any faction of the ruling class, which has repudiated the defense of democratic rights. The task falls to the international working class and is inseparable from the fight for socialism. The issues raised in this webinar are not matters of mere academic interest. They bear directly on the political struggles now unfolding. The WSWS urges its readers to study this discussion closely, to watch it in full, and to circulate it as widely as you can among coworkers, academics, students, and youth. U.S. Supreme Court strips refugees of protected status, blocks immigrants from applying for asylum. The U.S. Supreme Court on Thursday issued two virulently anti-immigrant decisions, authored by arch-reactionary Justice Samuel Alito on behalf of the six-justice right-wing bloc. The three moderate justices dissented. The rulings will have immediate and, in some cases, deadly consequences for hundreds of thousands of immigrants seeking refuge in the United States from political oppression, violence, and starvation in their countries of origin. The first, Mullen v. Doe, reverses multiple lower court rulings that former Secretary of Homeland Security Kristi Noem failed to follow appropriate procedures when she revoked the temporary protected status, TPS designation for refugees from Haiti and Syria. The TPS program was established in 1990 under the George H.W. Bush administration. Alito wrote that revocation of a TPS designation allows no judicial review whatsoever of either an individual decision or the chain of events leading up to a decision. In other words, all of the approximately 1.3 million immigrants who before Thursday were legally living and working in the U.S. under TPS designations, many for a decade or more, and some with children who are U.S. citizens by birthright, are instantly converted to undocumented aliens subject to immediate deportation to their countries of origin without any recourse to a court of law. Haiti was designated under TPS in 2010, shortly after the devastating earthquake that killed more than 300,000 in the impoverished former French colony, the location of history's only successful slave revolt. Presently, an estimated 350,000 Haitians live and work in the United States, the majority of whom fled following the assassination of President Jovenel Moise in July 2021, which left Haiti without a functioning parliament or executive branch. The country is essentially under the control of violent gangs sponsored by rival warlords in the Haitian ruling class. The police that remain are just as brutal as the gangs. A recent UN report documented 106 extrajudicial killings by law enforcement in just 3 months of 2024, including children as young as 10. The U.S. State Department has a level 4 do not travel advisory for Haiti, its highest, citing crime, terrorism, kidnapping, unrest, and limited health care. Syria was designated under TPS in 2012 after Ba'athist Bashar al-Assad's brutal crackdown on the Arab Spring protests that sparked 12 years of civil war. An estimated 50,000 Syrian refugees are living in the U.S. When revoking Syria's TPS designation, Noem claimed that the country was moving to a stable institutional governance under the sectarian Hayat Tahrir al-Sham party, a former al-Qaeda affiliate previously designated by Washington as terrorist. The TPS revocation occurred a few months after government forces massacred approximately 1,700 Alawites. Syria is again on the brink of civil war, with government forces squaring off against the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces. In addition to 400,000 Haitian and Syrian refugees, Thursday's ruling effectively erases lower court rulings that enjoin the Trump administration from revoking TPS designations, protecting hundreds of thousands of refugees from Venezuela, Somalia, and Ethiopia. There are almost 200,000 Salvadorans and over 50,000 Ukrainians living in the U.S., under TPS designations that are still in place but are now subject to summary revocation. Besides citing procedural flaws in Noem's revocation process, the refugees claim that the Trump administration acted with illegal racial animus, particularly in regards to Haitians. In dissent, Justice Elena Kagan wrote that race entered into the president's resolve to remove Haitians from this country, citing statements by the president so repellent and racially inflected that the majority declines to put them in print. Kagan listed examples from Trump's mouth. They're eating the dogs. They're eating the cats. They're eating the pets of the people that live in Springfield, Ohio. They are eating other things, too, that they're not supposed to be. Haitians in the U.S. probably have AIDS. Haiti is a shithole country, which is filthy, dirty, and disgusting. Haitian immigration is like a death wish for our country. Why is it we only take people from shithole countries like Haiti and Somalia? Why cannot we have some people from Norway and Sweden? Alito claimed these disgusting remarks are not overtly racial and excused them as heated language that exemplifies how political discourse by prominent public figures is increasingly couched in terms that would have scandalized the public just a short time ago. While the attack on Haitians is of a particularly filthy racist character, making revocation of TPS designations unreviewable is fundamentally an attack on the entire working class, which will not accept the wholesale deportation of co-workers and fellow students. In the second anti-immigrant ruling, Mullen versus Al Otro Lado, the same lineup of Supreme Court justices reversed the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, reinstating the practice of Customs and Border Protection, CBP officers, of turning away immigrants before they can cross into a port of entry, thus blocking their asylum applications under a law that grants people who arrive in the United States the right to apply for asylum. Prior to Trump's first inauguration in 2017, Democratic President Barack Obama implemented this so-called metering in response to a surge of Haitian refugees along the Mexican border. The result was a mushrooming of squalid, crime-ridden refugee camps in northern Mexico and a sharp increase in illegal crossings. Ignoring both the political context and human consequences of metering, Alito called the question straightforward, because no one would say that a person arrives in a place, for example, a house, a city, or a country, before the person enters that place. After surveying dictionaries, Alito rejected the contention that a person arrives at a place where someone is blocking entry. Alito's opinion was little more than a cut and paste of the Trump administration brief, incorporating the same puerile metaphors. In American football, a running back does not arrive in the end zone when he reaches the one-yard line, Alito wrote, nor does a letter arrive in the mailbox when a dog assaults the carrier a step away. Alito concluded, a person arrives in a destination only when he enters it, and that conclusion does not change because someone or something blocks entry. Brushing off the Refugee Act of 1980, which prohibits the return of refugees who face persecution, Alito wrote that the law imposes a duty on nations not to send refugees that are within their borders to certain places, not that refugees have a right to enter a nation at the time they prefer. Justice Sonia Sotomayor read an expanded summary of her dissent from the bench, displaying unusual emotion for a justice. She stated, "The consequences of today's decision are predictable. More people will die. More people will attempt to cross the border illegally, and some will make it while others will not." Referring to the MC St. Louis, the ship with more than 900 Jewish refugees from Nazi Germany that was turned away from U.S. shores and forced to return to Europe, where most wound up exterminated in concentration camps, Sotomayor wrote, "The majority's interpretation would allow immigration officers to refuse even to consider their asylum applications by physically blocking them from stepping foot onto U.S. soil." Sotomayor's courtroom summary was so powerful that Alito protested he was blindsided and had to respond. Nothing similar has previously happened in the Supreme Court. In yet a third 6-3 decision authored by Alito, Wolford v. Lopez, the Supreme Court overturned Hawaii's law that barred concealed firearms from private property open to the public, such as stores and restaurants, without the consent of the owners, claiming the law violated the Second Amendment right to bear arms, one of the few constitutional rights the current majority has expanded. Finally, defending big business from victims of malfeasance, a different alignment of Supreme Court justices ruled 7-2, Justices Neil Gorsuch and Ketanji Brown Jackson dissenting. That Bayer subsidiary Monsanto Company, the manufacturer of the pesticide Roundup, cannot be sued for negligently failing to warn of its cancer risks under state product liability laws, so long as its disclosures conform to those required by the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. Although Bayer and its insurance carriers have already paid billions in Roundup verdicts and settlements, the ruling jeopardizes an estimated 60,000 pending claims. Bayer stock rose 17% in trading after the decision was issued. Eight cases, including the rights of transgender athletes, Trump's authority to terminate members of the Federal Trade Commission and Federal Reserve Board, mail-in ballots, First Amendment protection for political contributions and birthright citizenship, remain to be decided before the end of the current Supreme Court term next week. More opinions will be released on Monday. Crushing prairie land sentences mark new stage in U.S. ruling class war on political opposition. The extraordinary prison sentences handed down this week in the Prairie Land Detention Center case mark a new stage in the war being waged by the U.S. ruling class against political opposition to its criminal rule. Eight defendants convicted in connection with the July 4, 2025 protest outside the Prairie Land facility in Alvarado, Texas, received a combined 450 years in prison. Benjamin Haneel Song, convicted of attempted murder of a law enforcement officer, was sentenced to 100 years. Maricela Rada received 70 years. Cameron Arnold, also known as Autumn Hill, Savannah Batten, Zachary Evitz, Bradford Morris, and Elizabeth Soto were each sentenced to 50 years, while Daniel Rolando Sanchez Estrada, who prosecutors acknowledge was not present at the protest itself, received 30 years. Sanchez Estrada was not accused of participating in the shooting, planning an attack, or providing material support to any alleged act of violence. Instead, he was sentenced to 30 years in prison after being convicted of concealing documents for moving a box containing artwork, journals, poetry, magazines, and anti-fascist zines after his wife, defendant Maricela Rueda, had been arrested. Prosecutors argued that these materials constituted evidence of the alleged conspiracy. In effect, Sanchez Estrada received a sentence longer than any imposed on a January 6, 2021 coup defendant for handling literature protected by the First Amendment. In fact, every Prairie Land defendant received a sentence longer than the harshest punishment imposed on any participant in the January 6th attack on the Capitol. While anti-IC protesters were sentenced to decades in prison under the banner of combating domestic terrorism, Trump granted sweeping clemency to more than 1,600 January 6th foot soldiers, including Proud Boys and Oath Keepers militia members. At least 97 of those recipients have since been arrested for, charged with, or convicted of additional crimes, including violent offenses, child sex crimes, domestic violence, stalking, grand larceny, and plots to kill law enforcement officers and public officials. The Justice Department hailed the verdict as the first sentencing of defendants affiliated with Antifa following President Donald J. Trump's executive order designating the group as a domestic terrorist organization in September 2025. Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche declared that the sentences make clear that Antifa terrorists who attack law enforcement and federal facilities will face swift and uncompromising justice, adding that their violent extremism has no place in our country. The administration is attempting to establish a sweeping new precedent that political beliefs and associations can serve as the basis for terrorism prosecutions carrying decades-long prison sentences. The government's theory rests on the proposition that left-wing political activity itself, including participation in organizations, possession of literature and communication with other activists, can constitute material support for terrorism. The government's claims collapse under the weight of the factual record. Prosecutors portrayed the protest as a coordinated terrorist assault on law enforcement, yet produced no evidence of a plan to carry out a mass casualty attack. There were no deaths. There was no organized attack. There was no Antifa terror cell. The only exchange of gunfire involved former Marine Benjamin Haneel Song and Alvarado police officer Thomas Gross. Song maintains that he fired after seeing Gross raise his weapon toward a fleeing protester. Whatever the legal issues surrounding that exchange, it does not justify the transformation of everyone present, and even those not present, into members of a terrorist conspiracy facing decades or life in prison. The conspiracy charges encompassed individuals accused of traveling together to the protest, communicating through encrypted messaging applications, possessing anti-ICE and anarchist literature, and participating in political organizations, including the Emma Goldman Book Club. Protected political speech, books, zines, online messages, and political associations figured prominently in the government's presentation of the case. The prosecution argued that such materials constituted material support for terrorism when combined with other evidence. The Prairieland prosecution is one component of a broader legal and political offensive by the U.S. ruling class to establish a police state and shred the Bill of Rights. Since returning to office, Trump has issued an executive order targeting alleged Antifa activity and signed National Security Presidential Memorandum 7, NSPM 7, ordering a nationwide crackdown against anti-Americanism, anti-capitalism, and anti-Christianity thought. Then Attorney General Pam Bondi followed with a memorandum directing federal prosecutors to aggressively pursue conspiracy and terrorism charges against political opponents. In May, the Trump administration released its America First counterterrorism strategy, drafted under the direction of Sebastian Gorka, Trump's senior director for counterterrorism. Gorka has long-standing ties to the Hungarian far right and has repeatedly promoted fascistic and anti-communist politics. Reflecting the political outlook dominating large sections of the ruling class, the strategy identifies violent left-wing extremists, including anarchists and anti-fascists, as one of the principal terrorist threats facing the United States, while making no mention of right-wing extremist violence. It repeatedly invokes the specter of left-wing extremism to justify expanded surveillance, investigation, and prosecution of political opposition. Prairieland is the first major test case under this framework. Under the guise of combating terrorism, the administration has sought to establish that opposition to ICE, membership in left-wing organizations, possession of political literature and communication with other activists can be treated as evidence of a terrorist conspiracy punishable by decades or life in prison. Federal prosecutors have since brought similar conspiracy charges against protesters in Minnesota and Michigan. In Minnesota, 15 individuals face conspiracy-related charges arising from protests against federal immigration kidnapping operations. In Michigan, federal prosecutors have brought conspiracy charges against anti-genocide demonstrators after an investigation that, according to the FBI, involved assistance from Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel's office. Nessel, a Democrat, had previously pursued state charges against a separate group of anti-genocide protesters before later dismissing them. The timing of this campaign is significant, as the federal government expands the use of domestic terrorism statutes against political protesters. Influential sections of the corporate media are simultaneously portraying socialism as a growing internal threat. One day after the New York City Democratic mayoral primary, in which three candidates backed by New York City Mayor Zohran Mamdani won, Rupert Murdoch's newspapers launched a coordinated campaign warning that socialism was on the march in America. The Wall Street Journal and the New York Post portrayed the victory of candidates backed by the Democratic Socialists of America, DSA, as an existential political threat, publishing editorials and opinion columns invoking Cold War imagery and suggesting the election represented a fundamental danger to the American political order. Trump himself followed with open anti-communist denunciations on social media, declaring America the Beautiful will never be a communist country, and in a separate post, warned of many communists running in badly failing blue states. The ruling class is not terrified of the DSA, which functions as a faction of the Democratic Party and works to contain growing opposition to capitalism within the framework of electoral politics. It is terrified of the broader social process reflected in the vote, the growing hatred among workers and youth for inequality, dictatorship, war, and the attack on immigrants. The corporate media's hysterical invocation of socialism is not an analysis of the DSA, but a warning from the ruling elite that any movement which threatens to escape its control will be met with repression. The response of the Democratic Party to the Prairie Land sentences has been virtual silence. As of this writing, the only elected Democrat who appears to have publicly commented is Michigan Representative Rashida Tlaib, who called the sentences a travesty and totally unjustified. Even this statement did not call for the convictions to be overturned, for the sentences to be vacated, or for the defendants to be freed. The World Socialist website requested comment from several Democratic elected officials, including Texas State Representative James Tallarico, who is currently running for the Senate. The only response received from Tallarico's office as of this writing was an automated email acknowledging receipt of the inquiry and providing links to donate to his campaign. Similar requests sent to Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Bernie Sanders had not received replies by the time of writing. The silence is not accidental. While Democrats posture as opponents of Trump, they have nothing to say when anti-ICE protesters are sentenced to decades in prison for alleged political association and opposition to Trump's mass deportation regime. In January of 2025, a sufficient number of Senate Democrats voted for the Locke and Riley Act to ensure its passage, vastly expanding mandatory immigration detention and handing the incoming administration sweeping new powers to jail immigrants without trial. More recently, Democratic congressional leaders maneuvered to ensure expanded funding of ICE and Customs and Border Protection, with no restrictions on their operations, even as millions protested the administration's mass deportation campaign. In recent protests outside the Delaney Hall Detention Center in Newark, New Jersey, it was Democratic officials who led the suppression of the demonstrations. New Jersey Governor Mikey Sherrill denounced demonstrators as outside agitators and deployed police to disperse protesters, while Newark Mayor Raz Baraka, also a Democrat, imposed a curfew to suppress opposition to the detention center. The Democrats are far more terrified of a mass socialist movement of the working class than they are of Trump's use of NSPM 7 to prosecute political opponents and destroy the First Amendment. The Prairie Land sentences underscore that the defense of democratic rights cannot be entrusted to the Democratic Party, its DSA operatives, or the courts. The struggle against dictatorship requires the independent political mobilization of the working class on a socialist and internationalist program directed against the capitalist system itself.
The World Socialist website is published by the International Committee of the Fourth International, the ICFI, the leadership of the World Socialist Movement, the Fourth International founded by Leon Trotsky in 1938. The World Socialist website relies entirely on the donations of readers and listeners for financial support. To give to the WSWS or to set up a regular monthly contribution, go to wsws.org/donate. We urge our listeners to join the International Committee of the Fourth International and one of its affiliated political parties and take up the struggle for socialism.